Yes. So as I was driving here this morning, I was listening to a program on the radio by a man who studies language and words and the evolution of language. And he was talking about even how our use of vowels has changed, our use of words have changed, phrases have changed. And in the time of Chaucer, they used to use this phrase about speaking that said, "I will investigate my hoard of words about this." So I have investigated my hoard of words for this talk with the benefit, you know, which they didn't have them, of books and internet and other people's Dharma talks and Wikipedia. So here it goes. And I'm going to start with a quote. "You can search the whole tenfold universe and not find a single being more worthy of love and compassion than the one seated here." The Buddha. And I found that my Zen practice has softened my harsh feelings toward myself and even led me at times to feel kindly toward myself. And this feeling of kindness and acceptance of oneself is referred to as self-compassion. And that is defined as extending compassion to oneself in instances of perceived inadequacy, failure, or general suffering. And psychologists have researched this and studied it, and even done PhDs on the topic. And I can just see my poor departed mother rolling her eyes about that. But Kristen Neff is a psychologist from Texas who first established self-compassion as a field of study about a decade ago. And she defined it as being composed of three main elements: self-kindness, common humanity, and mindfulness. So self-kindness, being warm toward oneself when encountering pain and personal shortcomings. Common humanity, recognizing that suffering and personal failure are part of the shared human experience rather than isolating. And then the third one is mindfulness that she identified. So these are really very in tune with Buddhist teachings. You know, self-kindness can be seen as a form of metta, you know, generating feelings of love and kindness towards oneself. May I be happy, may I be at peace, may I be free from suffering. And then common humanity, recognizing our shared suffering, is part of what Sangha is about. And then the third one she identifies is mindfulness, and that is pretty basic and very important. Because with mindfulness, we become aware of our thoughts and feelings as they arise, with acceptance and without endorsement. And self-compassion is seen as different from self-esteem, the development of which has been promoted for many years as a way to feel good about oneself and have a happier life. But here's a quote from Wikipedia. "Recent research has shown that the pursuit of high self-esteem can lead to narcissism, distorted self-perceptions, unstable self-worth, as well as anger and violence toward those who threaten the ego, as it is associated with measuring self-worth in externalized domains such as appearance, academics, and social approval." End quote. So the authorities are telling us to foster self-compassion over self-esteem. So what stands in the way of having self-compassion? And I think there's some common factors would be like guilt, the feeling of having done something bad, shame, the feeling of being bad, and self-criticism. And self-criticism is a very strong habit. In some ways, I think we develop and perfect it as a way to protect ourselves from criticism or ridicule from outside. And it is a hard habit to let go of. But I have found that even turning it down by just a few degrees can change my experience in deep ways, allowing for more space and relaxation during my days. And a popular label for self-criticism is the inner critic. I'm sure you've all heard that a lot in the popular media. And using a label can be helpful, because when we name something, it's easier to see it as outside of ourselves and not a part of us. So the painful thoughts and feelings that we sort of foster and harbor against ourselves can still arise, as they surely do during Sesshin, but they have less purchase when they come up, when we can label them. And Sharon Salzberg, who is a Buddhist teacher who's written many good books, has even given her inner critic a name, Lucy, from the comic strip Peanuts. And Lucy was notorious for her critical attitude. In one cartoon, she says to Charlie Brown, "You know what your problem is. The problem with you, Charlie Brown, is that you're you." So poor Charlie Brown bemoans, "What in the world can I do about that?" And she replies, "I don't pretend to be able to give advice. I merely point out the problem." So our inner critic continuously points out the problem. And even when we decide to give it up, we notice the seemingly endless loop, sort of the well-worn path in the mind forest. And this can lead to more self-criticism when we notice how bad we are at releasing it. And I've started to say to myself, when I notice like the tenacity of a habit that I've vowed to let go of, and I've studied it, I've developed techniques to deal with it, had therapy for it, and it keeps repeating itself mercilessly, instead of kind of trashing myself more and going like, "I'll never get over this," I start to tell myself, "I'm working on it." And I had a kind of an epiphany the other day while washing pots, just about this. And have you ever noticed how difficult it is to get cooked on egg white off a pot? So I was vigorously scrubbing away on some cooked on egg white and getting really frustrated that it would not come clean. So I decided to leave it to soak for a while, get a bit softer, and then come back and give it another scrub. And it took a few rounds. And it's just like cleaning away an unhelpful habit, like self-criticism. So let it soften a bit with patience and compassion, and then come back to it as many times as it takes. And it's interesting how we tend to really believe our self-critical thoughts as if they were the truth. They've even done studies about this next thing. We might hear about 99 good things about ourselves and tend to dismiss them, and then we hear one negative one and we like grab onto it and believe it. I grew up with a sister 1.5 years older than me, and she took it upon herself to put me down whenever possible. And she did a very good job of this. And it was many, many years before I had the insight, so like a flash of insight, that her motivation in saying these things was to make me feel bad about myself. She wasn't saying them because they were true, but I thought she would only say them if they were true. So when I was able to see it this way, it became a lot easier to let go of some of those internalized beliefs. So what are some common triggers of self-criticism? Like when is it hard to have acceptance and respect for self? And I think that there's lots of different areas, but some of them might be the domains of appearance, like how do I look? Am I pretty enough, handsome enough? Fitness, am I strong enough, healthy enough? Am I smart enough? Am I popular enough? Do I have enough friends? Parenting, am I a good enough parent? And even practice, you know, like, am I a good enough meditator? Do I do enough for the Sangha? And it's like any time that we compare ourselves with others, we can activate that inner critic. And for me, one of the hardest times to have self-compassion is when I'm in a situation where I don't know what to do and I feel like I should. And I get lots of opportunities for this because I'm a doctor. And don't you all believe a doctor should know what to do? So try believing this when you are a doctor. And most days at work, I'll get a cascade of self-criticism around not immediately knowing the best thing to do. And these little voices say, well, someone else would know. And what if they find out how bad I am? What if I make a mistake? I should have studied more. I should have a better memory. I should be smarter. I should retire. But when I think about it, you know, we're not born knowing very much. And we move from not knowing to knowing by learning. And we learn from the world and from each other. And this is Sangha. So that's one kind of knowing, the things that we learn through our life experiences. And there's another kind of knowing that comes from our Buddha nature, you know, our inner wisdom that we all have. And there is a koan, and this goes, Dizang asked Fayan, where are you going? Fayan said, around on pilgrimage. And Dizang said, what is the purpose of pilgrimage? Fayan said, I don't know. And Dizang said, not knowing is most intimate. I'm going to read from a talk that Norman Fisher gave about this koan. So he says, in this story, Dizang is asking Fayan not just about pilgrimage, but about spiritual practice, about life itself. For life is, after all, nothing but a pilgrimage. What's the purpose? Why are we born? Why do we die? Why is life so difficult? Why are we always longing for something else? What do we really know of our mysterious and fleeting experience? And Fayan's response is pretty honest. He doesn't just come out with some pious Buddhist answer, though we can be sure he knows many such answers. I don't know, he says, honestly and humbly, perhaps expecting Dizang, his teacher, to shed some light on the question. But Dizang says, I don't know is just right. I don't know is most intimate. And in Zen, the word intimacy is a synonym for awakening or enlightenment. And for me, this is Norman, intimacy is a much better word than these others. Zen enlightenment, realization, or awakening, all these words seem to imply some special state of mind or spirit, some kind of transformation or mystical knowledge or experience that somehow will bring us beyond life's day-to-day problems to a more spiritual plane. The word intimacy is better. It sounds like we are getting closer, deeper, more loving with our experience, rather than somehow beyond it. Intimacy better expresses what enlightenment really feels like. So how is it that not knowing is most intimate? And there's another little koan by a Zen master that said, the way is vast and wide. How could it ever be a matter of knowing or not knowing? Knowing is arrogant, not knowing is stupidity. The way is far beyond both of these. This tells us that Dizang's not knowing is something more and less than conventional idea of not knowing, which implies that there is something to be known, only we don't know it. Too bad for us, we are stupid. Dizang's not knowing isn't like this. It's not the opposite of knowing. It's beyond both knowing and not knowing. Or to put it another way, it's the real not knowing. When we know something and rest in that knowing, we limit our vision. We will only see what our knowing will allow us to see. In this way, our experience can be our enemy. True, our experience has shown us something about ourselves and about life. But this moment, this situation that faces us right now, this patient, this person, this family, this illness, this task, this pain or beauty, we have never seen it before. What is it? How do we respond? I don't know. I bow before the beauty and uniqueness of what I am facing. Not knowing, I am ready to be surprised, ready to listen and understand, ready to respond as needed, ready to let others respond, ready to do nothing at all if that is what is called for. And on a similar vein, the three tenets of the Zen Peacemakers, which that was Bernie Glassman's organization, and he developed these three tenets in 1994. And the first one, although they are interchangeable, is not knowing. And that's letting go of fixed ideas about yourself, others, and the universe. Not knowing trains you to continually set aside fixed points of view, letting go of the things you have relied upon for a sense of stability. You can then take shelter in the place before anything arises, a place of emptiness and profound silence, a place of the deepest rest where self-interest has not yet entered. So back to self-compassion and what kind of block that and trigger self-criticism. For me, another area that I find myself easily triggered into self-doubt and judgment is around appearance. You know that. How do I look? How do others see me? And this is fed into hugely by our culture. I've got another story here, kind of more related to this. And this one is from The Hidden Lamp, which is a book that brings us stories from 25 centuries of awakened women. And it's a collection of hidden koans told by women. And in the book, each koan has a commentary written by a contemporary woman teacher, teachers like Kuya Minogue, Joanna Macy, and Kate McCandless, to mention a few. And the one I'm going to read is number 34 in the book, and it's called The Zen Mirror of Tokeji. And read the koan and then a fair bit of the commentary, because I really like it. So the koan goes, the convent of Tokeji had a great mirror. The founding abbess, Kakuzon Shido, would meditate before it in order to see into her own nature. Later generations of nuns would practice Zazen in front of the mirror, concentrating on the question, where is a single feeling, a single thought, in the mirror image at which I gaze? Each abbess of Tokeji wrote a verse in response to the mirror practice. The following verse was composed by the fifth abbess, Princess Yodo. Heart unclouded, heart clouded, standing or falling, it is still the same body. So that's the koan. And the commentary for this one was by, I don't recognize this teacher, but it's Zenju Earthland Manual. Yeah, some people nodding. Oh. So she says, where is a single feeling, a single thought, in the mirror image at which I gaze? When we ask this question, at once we enter the purpose of our lives, which is to look upon our lives and discover who we are as living beings. We enter a dark abyss in which we encounter our heart, mind, and body. On the journey of discovery, we fall through the sky. At times the sky is clouded, and at other times it is unclouded. On the earth we plant our feet, and still we stumble. What are the clouds, and what takes them away? What makes us stand or fall? Looking into a mirror may seem easy, but being honest with what we see is difficult. A few days before my 59th birthday, I looked into the mirror to see if I looked old. I asked, am I old? What is old? I did this exercise for 5 minutes a day for 7 days. On the first day, I didn't see anything because I was afraid of seeing an old lady. My eyes constantly turned away. On the second day, I spent time plucking the hairs from my chin. I could see them clearly, the white hairs against my dark skin. They provided a nice distraction. On the third day, I thought, I should grow my hair longer so that the thinning parts would disappear. I remembered my mother's hair thinning in the same places when she was my age. Still, I didn't want to see my mother in me, nor see an old lady in myself. On the fourth day, as I looked in the mirror, I wondered what an old lady looked like, so I spent much of my day examining women as I walked in the world, deciding who looked old and who didn't. On the fifth day, I decided I must be old because my neck skin was beginning to sag like I had seen in the so-called old women the day before. On the sixth day, I cried in front of the mirror. I felt I had no control of my stumbling into old age. I felt my death was closer than ever before. On the seventh day, I saw fear in the tightness of my lips, confusion in the brow. I thought, what a tough journey life was. Then I looked deeper, without an idea in my head, just the question, what is old? And I saw a courageous woman, willing at least to look at herself. Thank you, Earthman. So, if we look at ourselves without thoughts of who or how we should be, without comparing, then compassion naturally arises. Just like in that story. So this could be a valuable practice, mirror practice. I don't know how many have done it. Just looking at our own reflection and being honest about what we see and what we feel. I may try it. And I have a friend. Her partner said of her one day, "You have the best self-esteem of anybody I know. When you look in the mirror, you smile at yourself." And the rest of us standing around hearing this, we all admitted that we never do that. And in fact, for me, there are some days I purposelessly avoid looking in the mirror to avoid the loud criticism that comes up. But I'm thinking, is this maybe a way to differentiate that distinction between self-esteem and self-compassion? So if we look in the mirror and smile and say, "Yo, I look good today," that sounds like self-esteem, right? It's not a bad thing for sure, but subject to change. And if we look in the mirror and smile and say, "I love you, life is hard, and you're doing a good job," that sounds a bit more like self-compassion. And we need to learn to love ourselves. Otherwise, our fear and our confusion block our ability to be present in the world and to see ourselves and each other. It makes us feel separate and alone. And we learn to love ourselves the same way we learn anything, from each other, from animals, and from the whole world, the earth herself. Buddhist teachings can help generate self-compassion. So knowing impermanence, we don't hold on to our fixed views of how we should be. Knowing that there is no enduring and separate self, and that we are all interconnected, protects us from feeling alone. And there's the three refuges. I take refuge in Buddha. So our Buddha nature, essentially, we are perfect just as we are in this very moment. I take refuge in Dharma. So Dharma, all the teachings guide us toward deeper self-compassion. I take refuge in Sangha. So Sangha, perhaps the most important of all. I once heard someone say, if you want to learn to love yourself, find someone else who loves you. So I am going to end with a quote and a poem. Hold yourself as a mother holds her beloved child, the Buddha. When I started this, I wasn't sure if the Buddha said anything about self-love and self-compassion, so I find it really comforting and inspiring to hear those quotes. And then the poem, it's one of my favorite ones by Mary Oliver, called Wild Geese, and right now I hear wild geese and see them every day flying overhead, so I think they're speaking to us. So, wild geese, you do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert repenting. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. Tell me about despair, yours, and I will tell you mine. Meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the sun and the clear pebbles of the rain are moving across the landscapes, over the prairies and the deep trees, the mountains and the rivers. Meanwhile, the wild geese, high in the clean blue air, are heading home again. Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination, calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, over and over announcing your place in the family of things. Thank you.